Welcome, friends. Welcome back to our cast. Hey, you know, some people say I say that friend thing too much, but I like this to be a friendly place. And speaking of friends, today I have a couple of colleagues of mine on the show, Fred Chong and Giampaolo Caro. Now, Giampaolo, sometimes we call him GP, just for short, easier for our American tongues to say. He's very happy, of course, with the outcome of the World Cup, and Giampaolo and Fred have been thinking about this area called software as a service. And it's an exciting area. A lot of developments are going on. And we think the trend out in the future is more and more in this direction, where you'll be using services, and they're just out in the cloud somewhere. You don't even care where they are or what platform they run on. You just care what they do. So let's give it up for Fred Chong and Giampaolo Caro.
Hey, this is Ron Jacobs coming to you once again on the ArtCast show, this time from my office here in Redmond, where I'm not at frequently, but here I am today after being gone for, it's gone for over 2 weeks. But we're back, and this time I'm joined by two colleagues, Giampaolo and Fred. Guys, welcome to ArtCast.
Hey, Ron, how are you?
Great. Globetrotter.
yeah, I'm fresh back from a trip to Egypt and Israel, and that was a lot of fun. But today we're going to be talking about SaaS. Now, when I was growing up, and if I talk back to my mother too much, she said, "Stop sassing me." Okay, but that's not what it is that we're talking about. What is, Giampaolo, what is SaaS anyway?
So SaaS stands for Software as a Service, which is this very popular trend that many people are, seeing in the industry. And one of the things that, Fred and I have been spending quite some time on is really understanding SaaS from an architectural perspective. What is it that you need to do as an architect to really shift your application to a delivery model that is not the on-premise model, but really deliver your software as a service?
Okay, so thinking about software as a service, Fred, is there an example that we could look at? I mean, is somebody out there actually doing this now?
Yeah, so the big daddy image that comes to people's mind when they talk about software as a service is Salesforce.com, who is offering a not an on-premise version of the CRM software, but one that does not requires on-premise installation, one that's accessed across the internet. So what they're offering is really a set of customer relationship management software, as opposed so the difference is that when people wanted to buy a line of business applications like a CRM applications and a pass, for example, or even currently, they would go to a vendor, a CRM vendor, whether it's Microsoft or somebody else, and installation of such software and maintenance of such software is typically quite complex. So they buy the software, they install on-premise, and then they have to worry about the ongoing maintenance of that, and so on and so forth. But with the internet version of CRM, one that, for example, Salesforce is offering, they can actually get all that functionality without having to install any of the software in-house.
Yeah, in the late 90s, before I came to Microsoft, I used to work for a couple of CRM vendors. And I recall what it was like. I was on the dev team, but I saw, these customers would come up. It was like a minimum of $1 million to buy this CRM software. And then you had to have a large project team assembled. There was customization work that had to be done. There was, put together the servers, have a team that's going to manage and monitor that. You also even had to have your own kind of help desk support for users of the CRM system. It was a really substantial investment on behalf of the customer to say, we're going to bet on this. But I can hear already, some people are going, okay, but yeah, you probably get something better, though, if you buy the internal thing. I mean, but is the experience of using software as a service, is it less desirable than the kind that you buy and you run yourself, or is it just about as good?
Well, it really depends on many aspects, but I can walk you through some of the impact from a buyer perspective of going with a software as a service offering as opposed to an on-premise. First of all, the big impact or one of the impacts is on the purchase, how you buy the software. There are different business models around software as a service, one of which is subscription. So as opposed to buying it with a large upfront licensing cost, then you put into your books and you amortize over time and what have you, it's much more an operating cost. You pay an amount every month to basically get access to that environment, a little bit like you would for electricity or rent and things like that. Also because the software does not need to be deployed in-house, there is no real deployment and implementation phase. There are many software as a service vendors that allow you to try the software before you buy it. And if you ask many enterprises if they would have loved to have tried the big line of business application they're using before buying them, you would have gotten a lot of people saying, yes, I would have loved that. So that makes the purchasing sort of aspect of software quite appealing. Second aspect is the operation of it. Instead of having an in-house department and having a large IT environment to operate and maintain that software, you basically offset that to the vendor, which is very different as an approach. So instead of managing people and resources, you manage business relationships. You manage service level agreements and things like that. So for smaller and medium businesses, it's actually quite appealing because they don't have access to an internal pool of IT that is required to run complex applications. So small and business enterprises potentially can get access to software that was historically only allowed or only capable to be run by large enterprises. That's why we see a lot of intake of SaaS in the small and medium business. And from the large enterprise corporation, which basically have the potential of running large business application, there is a, I wouldn't say a conflict, but there's a lot of discussion, mainly between the business side and the IT side, what would be the best approach to run software. So there is a difference in the purchasing of the software. There's an impact on the operation of the software. And obviously, when you provide such software, there's a big impact in the architecture of that software. If your software is meant to be used and deployed every time in each of the enterprises that uses it, it's very different than if you design a software that is meant to be used by many, many companies at the same time.
Yeah, okay, so you mentioned something there that's a, kind of a terminology that's used in this business. So you mentioned like the tenant. So if I am a customer and I subscribe to your service, let's say, I'm a tenant, right? I mean, somebody's using your service. And so from my point of view, what you do, what servers my application runs on, you know, how many servers and all that's opaque to me. I don't know. And I probably don't want to know. All I want to know is that it's running 24/7. I can use it whenever I want. So I'm relying on you to do what you have to do to make that happen. Now, but from the provider side of the architecture, there's got to be some challenges about, you know, how am I going to make that work? I mean, I don't want to provision a box for every single customer. And I mean, how do I make that work?
Okay, I'll start with that, and Fred, you can complement. So as you said, from a provider perspective, you only see yourself. So you want to be seen as if you were the only one. So you want to be the best customer of your provider, which is acceptable. From the provider side is now, how can I make all my tenant, all my customers, as if they were the only one, while maximizing the infrastructure that I've put in place? How can I make economy of scales while pretending or making believe that everyone is itself and alone on my environment? That's the challenge that architects have to solve. This is what we call single instance multi-tenancy. So a single instance of your application will be capable of running multiple organizations while behaving in such a way that each organization is treated as if it was the only one running on the infrastructure.
Yeah, but there's got to be some serious challenges about that. A lot of this reminds me of web hosting, you know, and that web hosters often would, you know, put several hundred or thousand sites on one box, and yet then you worry about, well, what if one of these sites gets really, really busy and starts soaking up all the bandwidth and the other sites on that box begin to suffer?
Correct.
And so then they would offer like a dedicated server package or maybe half a server or whatever. Do they do the same kind of things in SaaS? Or?
So exactly. So I was just describing the issue that has to be solved. The way you solve that is basically we have identified three main architectural topic that one has to be good at or master to successfully realize SaaS. One is to be multi-tenant efficient, that is, understanding how you can have a data model that allows a sharing of the database while protecting the data access to each of the tenants. Understanding how you can have service level agreement to each of your tenants and being able to monitor and enforce those service level agreements. So we can go into these details, but as right now, we just want to place them in the bucket of multi-tenant efficient. The second aspect that one has to master, or the capability that the software has to be able to provide, is customization per each of the tenants while running a single instance. This is done through a heavy usage of metadata. So you're going to have to describe the UI for each of your tenants, the business process for each of the tenants, the data model extensions for each of the tenants, in such a way that it's been inspected at runtime, and the behavior of your software will be such that by understanding who the tenant is, I will be looking at the metadata that describe the specificity of my tenant and act accordingly, while another tenant might make a similar request. But because the metadata associated to that request is different, my software will have to behave differently, which is a behavior of software that is not typical on today's on-premise application, because you don't have to cope with several requests on a single instance of your application with different data model, with different business processes, different UIs.
And would you, so I'm beginning to see some things that that might need to be accomplished here. So for one, in the UI customization, for example, it's very common for people who have done this kind of thing in the past to have use style sheets and that sort of thing to give the web page or the brand and look and feel mm-hmm. of the site they're hosting for, but when you get down into the business logic, it's been very difficult to make that work. But now there's a great new opportunity because of Windows Workflow Foundation to be able to describe using a metadata form, like a XAML form of a workflow, the workflow for this customer, which is different than that customer.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So if you look at how software applications are delivered today, especially the customized ones, what a lot of these systems integrators do is that they'll find out what your requirement is. They have a basic code base, and they'll go back and modify the code, and they recompile it and then deploy it for you. That method of delivering software has to change in the software as a service world, where the mentality has to be about minimizing, so you write your application once, and hopefully it caters to all the needs of your tenants. And what Gian Paolo has mentioned earlier on about metadata, that's really the key for delivering software as a service, because metadata is basically data about data. So it needs to describe what your tenants want to see, and your application has to be written in a way that at runtime it knows, based on your user context and what tenant you are, that is able to load the right metadata for you to cause the applications to run the correct way. And that, you know, goes for business logic. It goes for any extension that you make to your form as well, because the schema is different for every tenant now, right? Your PO looks different from mine, and how do I know that your PO has an extra field?
Yeah, and that was the always been a big problem, and often, you know, what the CRM companies I worked for did was they would have a number of extra fields, you know, just kind of, we called them user-defined fields, right? And they would just be a big, 255-character varchar in the database, right? And put whatever you want in there, and the UI would keep these fields invisible unless you wanted to use them. So kind of was an a cheap and easy way to extend the schema to support these. But as I was thinking about this, I was imagining a scenario where, let's say that I've purchased your service. I have some extra fields that you don't have normally in your schema. And then I have a legacy system that I want to integrate with your system. So now I'm going to need a web service that I can call. And the web service has to support these extra data elements. So, you know, maybe you have kind of a standard web service that anybody can call to access your thing, but mine's going to need to be a little different. It'll have a different contract because it'll have these extra data elements that the other one does not have. Would you then kind of create a special web service endpoint for me versus other people, or how would you handle that?
I think that there's actually different sort of, we can talk in terms of the data integration part from different maturity levels perspective. So I think that today's, for the most part, for today's software as a service provider, when they look at data integration, the kind of maturity level that we look at, in this case, maybe bootstrapping, you know, the data for the customer, would be, it could be as simple as maybe like an Excel spreadsheet or something like that. You give me the spreadsheet in a certain format that I want to see, and then I have a system in the back end that knows about the back end, and based on what you have given me in your Excel spreadsheet, I'm able to create the data model extensions for you and populate the data for you. I think when we get to the web service type of discussion, and I've actually definitely seen one customer in Singapore that actually has customized web service for every tenant. I think that this is one approach of doing it. I'm not convinced that it's the most scalable approach because we're still talking about customization for each tenant here, that you have to actually go and create a new web service to take the data. I think that there's probably a better way to do this. That's still sort of the ongoing part of our architecture guidance that we're looking to provide in the future.
And Ron, actually, this is a perfect example where you have this conflict between isolating versus sharing. So you can either take the isolating approach, so each of your customers will have an isolated web service access to your environment. Or you have to find a technique that through metadata, through configuration, you basically can construct dynamically the interface or the contract that is required for that particular tenant so that you can share the web service access among all those customers. So there again, you can architect your system so that you optimize for sharing by adding some tricks, if you will, mostly related to metadata manipulation and consumption at runtime. Or you can solve some of those through isolation by basically separating each of your customer at certain level, at the web services level, at the data level, at the business logic level. By isolating, you simplify some of your concerns, but you minimize your opportunity to have an economy of scale. It's going to cost you more to provide an isolated model because of more machines, more to manage, more to maintain, more to upgrade. On the other hand, by architecting this sharing environment so that you can offer a single instance to all your customers, you will be complexifying the architecture, so to speak, but you will be reducing the overall costs because you have less to maintain, less to run, and easier upgrade cycles and things like this. So how to choose, what to use, when, this is the architect's job. It will depend on other constraints. It will depend on the business model, depends on the customers. It will depend on so many extra constraints that I cannot give a definite answer. But that's the trade-off, or one of the major trade-off in software as a service is this tension between isolation and sharing.
Yeah, so I can imagine that mm-hmm. you could build your contracts so that there's an area for extensibility where you're going to send some, you know, random XML that's sort of self-describing, right, when the for each customer. So you have one endpoint that allows this extra area for customization, which is actually a pattern that I don't like very much. but I could see it might be very necessary in that kind of environment. If you wanted to have one endpoint to be able to support a lot of different customers that had slightly different customizations for metadata. Or maybe on the other hand, you could just charge a lot for customizations and say, if you want it, we're going to charge a lot more because it's going to increase our cost.
Correct. So from a web services contract perspective, it's a very, very delicate issue, and there is a lot of debate around that. And to be honest, I'm not sure we have definite answers to this. But you have to apply that thinking to all the layers. So you mentioned before Workflow Foundation helping out in customization of business processes per tenant. This is something we have more information about, we've been thinking more about, is, and you're right, the fact that you can describe your business process in an external format such as XAML, then be able to construct at runtime the specific workflow required for a particular tenant, this is a huge benefit of our platform in approaching those issues. So having in the metadata service this new thing you will have to have in your architecture in the SaaS environment, the delta definition of your workflow so that when you get the context of the caller, you identify who the caller is, you retrieve from that context the metadata associated to the business process and construct dynamically the workflow that has to be applied for that particular customer is a typical example of what one has to do to evolve their architecture to be multi-tenant aware. There might be some performance issues that you have to care about and cope with. So those are all the aspects that one has to think about. And as Fred mentioned earlier, the same thing applies to the data model. You mentioned a technique of applying a fixed set of custom columns or extension columns. That's a technique that is acceptable. You will have your data model that is defined, and then you have maybe 2, 3, 5 extra columns that are varchar or whatever, that are extension columns. You will then be in a potential environment where you have a very hollow table because not many will use all the fields. So you might potentially have issues in terms of the indexing and the performance and whatever. So there's another technique where, in addition to have your tenant ID column that defines who's the owner of each row, you have a column that defines the extension ID, and you basically reference to an extension table. And in that particular extension table, you value pairs of extension and things like this. So those techniques have been described in one of the white papers that we published on MSDN. So please go and have a look. And we're actually also complementing that guidance with follow-on papers. But to summarize this big rambling is that there are techniques to achieve this customization and is multi-tenancy aware. There is actually a wide range of techniques, and based on how much you wanna invest in the architecture as opposed into the operational cost or the isolation cost, then you will end up with different patterns.
Yeah, just in case it's not clear, I also just wanna add that customization, the ability to customize is not a binary thing. It's not so much as there is customization or no customization, because there's a degree of customizations in there. For example, the one that Gianpaolo mentioned was canned sets of extension. So we allow 3 extensions and no more than that. And you can call them anything you want. And this is easy to manage. Or we can say that, oh yeah, you can do anything you want under the sun for the extension. So it is a trade-off between how much you're willing to invest and how much the customer is really asking for that extensibility.
Okay, so, you know, there's one thing we didn't touch on yet, but I'm sure it's a concern to a lot of people, is the issue of security. Because, you know, a large organization, they have employees coming and going all the time. They worry about, well, you know, we just fired this guy yesterday, but today he can still access the external CRM site because, you know, you guys took a long time to take him out of your system or whatever. How do you manage, what are some of the security problems?
Yeah, so security is definitely the biggest issue that I think all potential customers of software as a service raise, that they have concerns, and it comes at different levels. So round the one that you mentioned, which is access, is one level, and the other area would be data privacy. So how do I prevent one tenant from looking at the other tenant's data is the other one. So regarding access, I think it all relates to the issue of provisioning. It has a very close relationship with that. So let's say if Microsoft today, you know, we offer a set of CRM software services, and Contoso is one of our customers. So one of the model that we allows them to their users to have access is by doing this thing called delegated administration, which is essentially saying that, yes, today, since you're paid us $100 a month, we'll create an admin user for you. And the responsibility of who within your organization that's allowed to access the application is your responsibility. So with the admin account, you can go and create new users, delete users, or change the permissions to different parts of the application, and that's your responsibility. And we provide a feature for you to do that. A more advanced software as a service provider may have an automated way for them to do it. Instead of having to log in and do it manually, they could potentially import some script or some data from the customers and do it automatically. Now, that's only provisioning, but deprovisioning is just as important, because when someone gets fired or whatever, you know, you want to try and reduce, minimize the window of bad employees going back and changing the data.
Erasing all the customers.
Exactly. Again, I think there are a couple of models. One is back to delegated admin. You have to make sure that the customer's admin is on top of things, that they go back and change and make sure that the user is deleted from the account, from accessing the application. The other way is, instead of doing delegated administration, there's a technique called identity federation, which means that there's a trust relationship between the software service as a service provider and the tenant's organization, you know, through X509, PKI, or something like that. But fundamentally, what's happening here is that the management of the users, the infrastructure that's required for managing the users, is not a directory that resides on the software service provider site, but instead it could be like an Active Directory on LDAP store that is already in the customer's organization. So they may already have some sort of deprovisioning process in place, something that happens really fast. Employees get fired and the system get notified and the user is deleted, which means that the user can no longer log into their systems. If they can't log into their own systems, they can't log into and have access to the SaaS app. So that's the other way of doing things.
Okay, so I'll go ahead.
Yes, just wanted to add something here, because what we basically have just heard are issues that are already seen in software, in SOA type of applications. So one thing that I wanted to point out is, because I've been asked many times, is, well, SaaS and software as a service isn't just the same thing as SOA. Well, we could spend 20 ArcCasts just on that topic.
But, and we should, yeah. Okay, no, let's
but,
go.
But at the high level, I think there are very, there is some set of principles that are very similar. So the fact that you are experienced in delivering line of business application in the enterprise space, the fact that you understand the issue of service orientation, the fact that you understand what the impact of identity is in this type of system, will help you being a good SaaS architect. And a typical example here, Fred and myself have been involved heavily in the last few years in working and designing SOA applications. So, and we are realizing that a lot of that experience is applicable to SaaS. This said, there are some specific architectural concerns and new architectural patterns that have to be created or identified for the specificity of software as a service, and the customization area is one of them. The multi-tenancy awareness and is one of them. But there is a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of experience out there that is directly applicable into that space. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I totally agree, because I think if you get service orientation, then you're going to already be aware of a lot of these issues. But providing the same service to multiple customers is a new wrinkle on that. But let me ask one other question, because I think this is another big concern people have. If let's say I try CRM vendor A, and so we've been using them for a year, and it's been working okay, but we're not super happy with them, and we go, you know what, we're going to go to their competitor, yep, CRM vendor B. And then CRM vendor A says, well, okay, fine, but, you know, we're not going to give you your data.
Yeah,
you know, you're stuck. In the contract, in the fine print, it says the data really belongs to us because it lives on our servers. Or something dumb like that. I mean, what happens then?
Yeah, so I actually, it's funny, because I had this conversation not too long ago, and my answer was, the data belongs to who has the best lawyer. Obviously, it's a kind of a joke there, but it basically elevates something that is important, that there is a need, whether we like it or not, of a legal framework around this relationship that exists between your provider and yourself. So when you are doing everything in-house in a SOA, your large enterprise, you don't have this type of issues because the data is yours, it's stored in your servers, there is no issue there. When you start having data that belongs to you, or at least is created by you in someone else's servers, then obviously I don't know what the law would say about this, but what I do know is that a contract has to be put in place to clarify that. And to be honest, there are actually some software as a service company, and I can name, well, without naming them, there are some even email companies like offered over the web that their business model resides in looking at your data. So the ad you will be getting is based on the email content that you receive. Well, are they allowed to do that? Well, most likely in the user, you know, the EULA, they say they're allowed to.
Oh, but you mean that thing that I don't read and I just click accept? It says something in there,
correct,
right?
Correct. So there is an element there that is of interest, but definitely understanding data ownership is critical. But even beyond the data ownership aspect from a legal perspective, what's my data, your data, there's another element that is more technical in nature, is how do I migrate the data that is out there to this new provider? Is the provider capable of extracting that data for me to reuse? Maybe the best they can do is give me a zip file with a select star from all the tables where tenant ID equal tenant ID, give all the bunch of data back and say, deal with it.
Yeah.
Or maybe they've provided some sort of APIs that allows to access the business entity to move them around. So on one hand, the provider might not have an incentive to provide an easy migration out of their environment, but maybe the industry will require that to happen. Otherwise, they will not have customers. So typically, if I'm a customer and I want to provide and purchase software from my provider, I want to make sure that I'm clear on how I can get the data out, not because necessarily I want to change provider, but what if that provider disappears? Like, it's a startup and goes away, bankrupt. I don't want to die with that.
So that brings up another thought, right?
Yeah.
So for the industry standard group, if SaaS is truly successful, maybe the new mantra for this industry group will be on data migration standards rather than protocol standards.
Well, you know, when you think about, I mean, you could have a terabyte of data to get migrated from point A to point B. That's not like, you're not going to make a web service call to get that. You know, you're not going to burn it on a DVD and FedEx it to me. I mean, I don't know what you would do, but it's going to be big problem.
You ship the machine or something. I don't know. But yeah. Then again, it's going back to something we discussed earlier, is this concept of isolation versus sharing. If you're in a purely isolated environment, your data will sit in a box that belongs to you, and actually, quite rightly, you can go and get the box, and the data will be in that box. If now you're in an environment where your data is co-located with everybody else, and you're the only one wanting the data out, it's going to be different. To, you know, the process to getting the data out would be very different if you're in a shared environment or isolated. So you might have benefited of a different cost structure because you're buying your environment on a shared environment, and the provider might have benefited from a cost perspective to sharing a lot of their environment, but they will be paying at some point if they need to extract specific elements out of the database.
You know, it also brings up an issue about disaster recovery, mm-hmm. backup and restore. Let's say, for example, that we find out that somebody in our company has been intentionally, you know, destroying records, and so we call the vendor and we say, we need to restore from the beginning of this month, just us, not any other tenant, just us.
The current maturity of the industry in the software industry space, and with all the people we talk to, none of them were capable of doing that in a shared environment. It's not that it's not possible.
Yeah.
It's because the choices they made in their architecture, the investment they've made in evolving to that model, made them either isolate the database. So if you want backup, then you need to go in this isolated space. If you go in the shared environment, then we are not capable of giving you a backup and recovery per customer, per tenant.
Yeah.
My claim is, once our guidance is out, they will be able to do that.
Yeah.
Because the evolution of the provider will make so the maturity level will increase, and they will be architecting their environment in such a way that even though they're in a shared environment, they are co-locating data. They are capable of extracting and doing backup and recovery per tenant. That will require, as I said, some specific ways of handling the data, of storing the data, of tagging the data, and again, we go back to the metadata service, to allow this. Today, we don't see much of that, but just because also the maturity is quite low, if you will, in advanced features. But certainly, over the next few months, years, or whatever, this will be critical to have.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You know, if this was really a mission critical process, I might want to have a deal with the service provider where they, you know, maybe once a month they send me a set of DVDs of the backed up data from their side, even so that if they had a big earthquake at their data center or something, who knows, whatever, right? I mean, these are kind of things I might want to do.
Actually, getting your data is something that they have already. So getting a backup of your data on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, I've seen that happening often. So basically, it's a zip file that is stored on a CD and is shipped off-site or whatever. What I was talking about was to restore the data back into the operational environment, which is a different process than backupping it. So backup of each tenant, this is critical. No one could offer a service if the backup is not possible.
Yeah.
It's the per tenant restore that today is not available.
Okay, well, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing how you guys come up, what kind of solution you come up with for that one. But I mean, I can imagine some ideas. But I mean, that's the great thing about our team here is that, you know, you guys can sit down with some architects from the SQL team, talk to them about this problem.
We've got one in-house now.
Yeah, that's right. We do. Yeah. And you know, we can say, hey, Roger, what should we do here? You know, that's Roger Walter, our colleague who is formerly from the SQL team, now on our team. So this is going to be really great stuff. So you're writing up some guidance. You're putting it on the
MSDN architecture. Yeah,
Architecture Developer Center, so people can look it up there.
Yes,
and we'll have a URL for folks to look at. I hope. Right.
Well, in fact, the first paper is already out.
Oh, okay, great.
We might want to include a link.
Yeah.
For the webcast announcement.
Super. All right. Well, thanks you guys for joining me.
Well, thanks, Ron.
Right.
Was
Thank
fun.
You.
Fred Chong and Jean-Paul Ocaro, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, thinking about software as a service. You know, the more you open this book, the more you think about all these issues that are going on, both on, if you want to be on the service provider side, or even if you're on the consuming side, some questions you ought to be asking of your service provider. Like that whole thing about, could you restore just my data? Or could you back up just my data? And what am I going to do when I get sick of you as a provider and I want to go to somebody else? I mean, there's so many questions here. And everybody's grappling with what's the right thing to do. And so Fred and Giampaolo are thinking about these issues. They have an article in our .NET Architecture Journal. And so you might want to take a look at that. And we'll see you next time here on ArtCast.